The President of the United States is dead. I repeat, the President of the United States is dead. Het was een bericht dat herhaald moest worden, enkele keren achter elkaar. Op alle radio- en televisiezenders van de Verenigde Staten en trouwens van de gehele wereld. En het werd met nadruk herhaald omdat het zo ongeloofwaardig klonk. Omdat het zo onvoorstelbaar onwaarschijnlijk was dat de levensdraad zou zijn afgesneden van de jonge man die de dynamische leider was van het Amerikaanse volk en de vader van een jong gezin. Een man wiens rol in de wereld nog maar nauwelijks was begonnen. Want nog geen 3 jaar geleden, op 20 januari 1960, had John Fitzgerald Kennedy door het afleggen van de ambtseed zijn hoge en verantwoordelijke functie aanvaard.
You, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
That you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of your ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Terstond daarna bereidde hij vriend en vijand een grote verrassing. Alle meenden dat de presidentsverkiezing was gewonnen door een eerzuchtige jonge man. Want het was ambitieus om te trachten als 43-jarige de eerste katholieke president van de Verenigde Staten te worden. En men meende dat hij zijn succes voor een groot deel dankte aan zijn behendigheid als politicus en aan een goed gefinancierde verkiezingscampagne waarbij van alle moderne technische en psychologische middelen gebruik was gemaakt om stemmen te winnen. Maar in zijn inaugurale reden al leerde de Amerikanen en leerde de wereld een hele andere man kennen. Hij sprak namens een nieuwe generatie, een jonge generatie, wel een die de grote oorlog had meegemaakt, maar die tijdens die oorlog niet tot de vooraanstaande leiders had behoord, zoals een Eisenhower en Churchill, een De Gaulle of een Macmillan, dat lag voor de hand. Amerika had gekozen voor de krachtige leiding van een jonge man, maar die jonge man bleek helemaal niet een behendig politicus te zijn, en zelfs niet een man die zich wilde modelleren naar het gebruikelijke voorbeeld van succesvolle Amerikaanse presidenten, van wie men verwacht dat zij vertrouwen op hun persoonlijke intuïtie en hun flair en laten blijken van warmvoelende menselijkheid en hartelijkheid. De jonge John Kennedy bleek een zeer ernstig man te zijn, die Amerika als wereldmogendheid wilde geven wat hij en zijn vrienden noemden thoughtful leadership, en die zich bij zijn bewind in de eerste plaats wil laten leiden door de grote principes waarop de Amerikaanse staat en samenleving was gebouwd. Dit zei hij in zijn inaugurale reden.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. This much we pledge and more. To those old allies whose cultural and spiritual origins we share, we pledge the loyalty of faithful friends. United, there is little we cannot do in a host of cooperative ventures. Divided, there is little we can do, for we dare not meet a powerful challenge at odds and split asunder. To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny. We shall not always expect to find them supporting our view, but we shall always hope to find them strongly supporting their own freedom. And to remember that in the past, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe, struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. To our sister republics south of our border, we offer a special pledge to convert our good words into good deeds in a new alliance for progress to assist free men and free governments in casting off the chains of poverty. But this peaceful revolution of hope cannot become the prey of hostile powers. Let all our neighbors know that we shall join with them to oppose aggression or subversion anywhere in the Americas. And let every other power know that this hemisphere intends to remain the master of its own house. To that World Assembly of Sovereign States, the United Nations, our last best hope, in an age where the instruments of war have far outpaced the instruments of peace, we renew our pledge of support to prevent it from becoming merely a forum for invective, to strengthen its shield of the new and the weak, and to enlarge the area in which its writ may run. Finally, to those nations who would make themselves our adversary, we offer not a pledge, but a request that both sides begin anew the quest for peace. Before the dark powers of destruction, unleashed by science, engulf all humanity in planned or accidental self-destruction. So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
De thema's van die eerste reden komen herhaaldelijk in zijn toespraken terug. Vrijheid voor alle mensen. Een menswaardig bestaan voor allen, in Amerika en daarbuiten. En dan vrede. Het werd snel duidelijk dat deze jonge man niet zozeer werd gedreven door een persoonlijke eerzucht en dat niet eigen glorie zijn doel was, maar dat hij gedreven werd door de brandende begeerte om verantwoordelijkheid te dragen en zich van grote plichten te kwijten. Het eerste jaar van zijn presidentschap bood hem niet veel gelegenheid zijn idealen te verwezenlijken. De westelijke wereld was in het defensief. President Kennedy bezocht Europa en ontmoette in Wenen zijn grote tegenspeler, premier Nikita Sergejevich Khrushchev, de secretaris-generaal van de communistische partij in de Sovjet-Unie. En teruggekeerd in de Verenigde Staten, juli 1961, moest de president in een televisietoespraak het Amerikaanse volk vertellen dat de situatie in de wereld hem dwong om de defensiebegroting te verhogen en de Amerikaanse strijdkrachten te versterken. Al bleef het doel van de Amerikaanse politiek de vrede en was Amerika voortdurend tot overleg bereid. Gelijk hij had gezegd, laat ons nooit onderhandelen uit vrees, maar ook nooit bevreesd zijn om te onderhandelen.
Good evening. 7 weeks ago tonight, I return from Europe to report on my meeting with Premier Khrushchev and the others. His grim warnings about the future of the world, his aide memoir on Berlin, the subsequent speeches and threats which he and his agents have launched, and the increase in the Soviet military budget that he has announced, have all prompted a series of decisions by the administration and a series of consultations with the members of the NATO organization. In Berlin, as you recall, he intends to bring to an end, through a stroke of the pen, first, our legal rights to be in West Berlin, and secondly, our ability to make good on our commitments to 2 million people of that city. That we cannot permit. Let me remind you that the fortunes of war and diplomacy
left the free people of West Berlin in 1945, 110 miles behind the Iron Curtain. Thus, our rights there are clear and deep-rooted. But in addition to those rights is our commitment to sustain and defend, if need be, the opportunity for more than 2 million people to determine their own future and choose their own way of life. Thus, our presence in West Berlin and our access thereto cannot be ended by any act of the Soviet government. We will at all times be ready to talk, if talk will help. But we must also be ready to resist with force, if force is used upon us. Either alone would fail. Together they can serve the cause of freedom and peace. The new preparations that we shall make to defend the peace are part of the long-term buildup in our strength, which has been underway since January. They are based on our needs to meet a worldwide threat, on a basis which stretches far beyond the present Berlin crisis. Our primary purpose is neither propaganda nor provocation, but preparation. We do not intend to abandon our duty to mankind to seek a peaceful solution. As signers of the UN Charter, we shall always be prepared to discuss international problems with any and all nations that are willing to talk and listen with reason. If they have proposals, not demands, we shall hear them. If they seek genuine understanding, not concessions of our rights, we shall meet with them. We have previously indicated our readiness to remove any actual irritants in West Berlin. But the freedom of that city is not negotiable. We cannot negotiate with those who say, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is negotiable. But we are willing to consider any arrangement or treaty in Germany consistent with the maintenance of peace and freedom and with the legitimate security interests of all nations. We recognize the Soviet Union's historical concern about their security in Central and Eastern Europe after a series of ravaging invasions. And we believe arrangements can be worked out which will help to meet those concerns and make it possible for both security and freedom to exist in this troubled area. For it is not the freedom of West Berlin which is abnormal in Germany today, but the situation in that entire divided country. If anyone doubts the legality of our rights in Berlin, we are ready to have it submitted to international adjudication. The world is not deceived by the communist attempt to label Berlin as a hotbed of war. There is peace in Berlin today. The source of world trouble and tension is Moscow, not Berlin. And if war begins, it will have begun in Moscow and not Berlin. If new threats in Berlin or elsewhere should cause us to weaken our program of assistance to the developing nations, who are also under heavy pressure from the same source, or to hold our efforts for realistic disarmament, or to disrupt or slow down our economy, or to neglect the education of our children, then those threats will surely be the most successful and least costly maneuver in communist history. For we can afford all these efforts and more, but we cannot afford not to meet this challenge. If we do not meet our commitments to Berlin, where will we later stand? If we are not true to our word there, all that we have achieved in collective security, which relies on these words, will mean nothing. And if there is one path above all others to war, it is the path of weakness and disunity. Today, the endangered frontier of freedom runs through divided Berlin. We want it to remain a frontier of peace. The Soviet government alone can convert Berlin's frontier of peace into a pretext of war. The steps I have indicated tonight are aimed at avoiding that war. To sum it all up, we seek peace, but we shall not surrender. That is the central meaning of this crisis and the meaning of this government's policy. With your help and the help of other free men, this crisis can be surmounted. Freedom can prevail, and peace can endure.
In de herfst van datzelfde jaar 1961 nam hij dat thema weer op. De gelegenheid was een toespraak tot de Algemene Vergadering van de Verenigde Naties, die op dat ogenblik de dood van haar secretaris-generaal Dag Hammarskjöld met een vliegtuig neergestort tijdens een missie in Congo betreurde. President Kennedy schetste de situatie in de wereld, verklaarde zich wederom bereid tot overleg, in het bijzonder om de bewapeningswedloop met atoomstrijdkrachten te staken, maar herhaalde dat de Verenigde Staten hun verplichtingen zouden nakomen, al zouden zij zelf nooit aanvallen.
Mr. President, honored delegates, ladies and gentlemen, we meet here in an hour of grief and challenge. Dag Hammarskjöld is dead, but the United Nations lives. His tragedy is deep in our hearts, but the tasks for which he died are at the top of our agenda. A noble servant of peace is gone, but the quest for peace lies before us. This will require new strength and new roles for the United Nations. However difficult it may be to fill Mr. Hammarskjöld's place, it can better be filled by one man rather than by three. Even the three horses of the Troika did not have three drivers, all going in different directions. They had only one, and so must the United Nations executive. Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. The risks inherent in disarmament pale in comparison to the risks inherent in an unlimited arms race. It is in this spirit that the recent Belgrade conference, recognizing that this is no longer a Soviet problem or an American problem, but a human problem, endorsed a program of general, complete, and strictly and internationally controlled disarmament. It is therefore our intention to challenge the Soviet Union not to an arms race, but to a peace race, to advance together, step by step, stage by stage, until general and complete disarmament has been achieved. We invite them now to go beyond agreement in principle, to reach agreement on actual plans. The logical place to begin is a treaty assuring the end of nuclear tests of all kinds, in every environment, under workable controls. The United States and the United Kingdom have proposed such a treaty that is both reasonable, effective, and ready for signature. We are still prepared to sign that treaty today. To destroy arms, however, is not enough. We must create even as we destroy. Creating worldwide law and law enforcement as we outlaw worldwide war and weapons. And as we extend the rule of law on Earth, so must we also extend it to man's new domain, outer space. My country favors a world of free and equal states. We agree with those who say that colonialism is a key issue in this assembly. Let us debate colonialism in full and apply the principle of free choice and the practice of free plebiscites in every corner of the globe. Finally, as President of the United States,
I consider it my duty to report to this assembly on two threats to the peace. The first threat on which I wish to report is widely misunderstood. The smoldering coals of war in Southeast Asia. Secondly, I wish to report to you on the crisis over Germany and Berlin. If there is a crisis, it is because an existing peace in that area is under threat. Because an existing island of free people is under pressure. Because solemn agreements are being treated with indifference. The elementary fact about this crisis is that it is unnecessary. If there is a desire for change, it must be a subject for negotiation. And if there is negotiation, it must be rooted in mutual respect and concern for the rights of others. I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression, that we shall neither flee nor invoke the threat of force, that we shall never negotiate out of fear, and we shall never fear to negotiate. And it is in the light of that history that every nation today should know, be he friend or foe, that the United States has both the will and the weapons to join free men in standing up to their responsibilities. Ladies and gentlemen of this assembly, the decision is ours. Never have the nations of the world had so much to lose or so much to gain. Together we shall save our planet, or together we shall perish in its flames. Save it we can, and save it we must. And then shall we earn the eternal thanks of mankind, and as peacemakers, the eternal blessing of God.
Het volgend jaar kwam het dramatische hoogtepunt dat een keerpunt zou blijken te zijn. Een Amerikaans verkenningsvliegtuig bracht foto's mee die buiten twijfel stelden dat specialisten uit de Sovjet-Unie op het eiland Cuba van Fidel Castro offensieve raketbases bouwden die een groot deel van het westelijk halfrond onder het bereik van Russische raketten zouden kunnen brengen. Dit in weerwil van Russische verklaringen dat de Sovjet-Unie het politieke en het militaire evenwicht in de wereld niet zou verstoren. Op dat dramatische ogenblik nam de jonge president een beslissing die van hem een groot staatsman maakte. Met de gelukkige mengeling van onverschrokkenheid en matiging die zijn handelen en denken altijd had gekenmerkt, stelde hij het antwoord van de Verenigde Staten op. In een televisietoespraak die de gehele wereld met ingehouden adem aanhoorde, deelde hij mede dat de Amerikaanse strijdkrachten het eiland Cuba zouden isoleren, dat het eiland in quarantaine werd gesteld, dat alle schepen en vliegtuigen met bestemming Cuba zouden worden aangehouden en onderzocht, ook de Russische. Dat was een uitdaging van de Sovjet-Unie en het wereldcommunisme, die tot een onbeperkte nucleaire oorlog zou hebben kunnen leiden. President Kennedy deed een ernstig beroep op premier Khrushchev om zijn voornemens op te geven. En met grote wijsheid gaf hij de Sovjet-Unie zoveel mogelijk gelegenheid om zich terug te trekken, al zou dat niet zonder kleerscheuren gaan. En zijn krachtige ingreep had succes. Het gevaar werd afgewend.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Upon receiving the first preliminary hard information of this nature, last Tuesday morning at 9 a.m., I directed that our surveillance be stepped up. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area. Additional sites not yet completed appear to be designed for intermediate-range ballistic missiles, capable of traveling more than twice as far, and thus capable of striking most of the major cities in the Western Hemisphere, ranging as far north as Hudson's Bay, Canada, and as far south as Lima, Peru. In addition, jet bombers, capable of carrying nuclear weapons, are now being uncrated and assembled in Cuba, while the necessary air bases are being prepared. This urgent transformation of Cuba into an important strategic base by the presence of these large, long-range, and clearly offensive weapons of sudden mass destruction constitutes an explicit threat to the peace and security of all the Americas in flagrant and deliberate defiance of the Rio Pact of 1947, the traditions of this nation and hemisphere, the joint resolution of the 87th Congress, the Charter of the United Nations, and my own public warnings to the Soviets on September 4th and 13th. This action also contradicts the repeated assurances of Soviet spokesmen, both publicly and privately delivered, that the arms buildup in Cuba would retain its original defensive character, and that the Soviet Union had no need or desire to station strategic missiles on the territory of any other nation. The size of this undertaking makes clear that it has been planned for some months. Yet only last month, after I had made clear the distinction between any introduction of ground-to-ground missiles and the existence of defensive anti-aircraft missiles, the Soviet government publicly stated on September 11th that, and I quote, "The armaments and military equipment sent to Cuba are designed exclusively for defensive purposes," unquote. That there is, and I quote the Soviet government, "there is no need for the Soviet government to shift its weapons for a retaliatory blow to any other country, for instance, Cuba," unquote. And that, and I quote the government, "the Soviet Union has so powerful rockets to carry these nuclear warheads that there is no need to search for sites for them beyond the boundaries of the Soviet Union," unquote. That statement was false. Only last Thursday, as evidence of this rapid offensive buildup was already in my hand, Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko told me in my office that he was instructed to make it clear once again, as he said his government had already done, that Soviet assistance to Cuba, and I quote, "pursued solely the purpose of contributing to the defense capabilities of Cuba," unquote. That, and I quote him, "training by Soviet specialists of Cuban nationals in handling defensive armaments was by no means offensive. And that if it were otherwise," Mr. Gromyko went on, "the Soviet government would never become involved in rendering such assistance," unquote. That statement also was false. Neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation, large or small. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. The foreign ministers of the OAS, in their communique of October 6, rejected secrecy on such matters in this hemisphere. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities, and I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. Fourth, as a necessary military precaution, I have reinforced our base at Guantanamo, evacuated today the dependents of our personnel there, and ordered additional military units to be on a standby alert basis. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race. My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. No one can foresee precisely what course it will take or what costs or casualties will be incurred. Many months of sacrifice and self-discipline lie ahead, months in which both our patience and our will be tested, months in which many threats and denunciations will keep us aware of our dangers. But the greatest danger of all would be to do nothing. The path we have chosen for the present is full of hazards, as all paths are. But it is the one most consistent with our character and courage as a nation and our commitments around the world. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved. Thank you, and good night.